You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
Howard Roark and the Great Heroes of Literature by Andrew Bernstein.
Yes, this is Howard Roark and the Great Heroes of Literature. We have an enormous amount of material to cover and only an hour to do it. And although Anu thinks I'm fun, I know she'll send her minions in to kick us out when our time is up. But so let's get right into this. The Fountainhead, this is really an honor for me because The Fountainhead is my all-time favorite book ever. Fiction, nonfiction, this is my personal favorite book, has been since I was 16. Still is. So this is the 75th anniversary of The Fountainhead, but it's the 50th anniversary for me since I read it for the first time. So I want to thank everybody for coming to help me celebrate my 50th anniversary. So thank you. Now we're going to ask the question here: who are the great heroes of literature? And I have a list. You got to have a list. But it's not a definitive list. There could be others on it. I don't get this list from Mount Sinai. I believe it or not, once in a while I make errors. And there's a certain amount of subjectivism here. I picked out my personal favorite heroes to discuss. It's good to be the king, right? But it raises sub questions here. What does it mean to be a hero? What are the criteria by reference to which we measure a hero? Can we form a definition of hero? Now, I wrote a book on this theme. It's not published yet, but I worked on it for 5 years, and it's just about ready to publish. And I think if you look at the literature on heroes, first of all, you start with a dictionary. If you want a definition, even a really good dictionary, and I think the best dictionary of American English is the American Heritage Dictionary, the 5th edition. It's excellent. But it's the dictionary definitions for heroes, references mythological figures, gods, legends, and mostly warriors. The dictionary's not of much help here. But there have also been many books written on heroes and heroism, but every one of them, without exception, does not offer a rigorous definition of hero. They often use the term elusive when they talk about how difficult it is to define hero. Now, I believe I cracked the code on this, that my book, that I've defined what heroes is. I'm going to make use of that here, but I'm not going to scoop my book, and I'm not going to tell you the method on how to do that. I'll wait for next year. But here's the structure for the talk. I want to start off with the criteria. I'm not going to validate the criteria. I'm just going to list them. Then who the heroes are, and then the analysis to see, who is the greatest of these heroes? Before we jump in, I want a few more caveats. I'm not using Atlas Shrugged here for one simple reason. And right from the outset, I want to get clear on this. Atlas Shrugged is sui generis in the history of world literature in terms of its plot structure and its hero. I don't know of any other story in which a hero, one, completely and utterly dominates the action of a story, while two, remaining invisible behind the scenes for fully two-thirds of that story. Unknown to the primary narrators and consequently unknown to the readers. It's a literary tour de force in plot structure on Ayn Rand's part. She hasn't begun to receive the praise that she deserves. So I'm going to stick with the plot structures that are the standard tried and true hero stories where you see the hero right from the outset and he goes ahead and crushes the opposition. And it's all visible to the readers. And one last thing, I hope with this audience we can avoid any identity politics here. And I'm not going to get any questions, I hope, on... one good way to obviate that is just to use the full 60 minutes and then no questions. But, no questions on why are all these heroes men? Why are they white males? I mean, just let me... This is... I'm taking these great books out of Western civilization, which have been written largely by dead white males, although we have a dead white female in here, too, the greatest novelist in world literature, right? Ayn Rand. But let me say this. when objectivism becomes a dominant philosophy in the culture, I think it's gonna bring about a renaissance in the field of literature and the other arts. We will rout the anti-hero mentality. We will see many books written about, you know, great heroes, about female heroes, white, black, Asian, Latino, biracial, multiracial heroes, all types of human heroes that we can admire. But, so no identity politics here, let's jump in. What are the qualities of a hero? Now, obviously, I'm giving this lecture and writing my book on heroism from an objectivist standpoint. And I think one criterion of a hero is that he or she holds values that are objectively life-promoting. It holds values that benefit human life on Earth, that are in accordance with human nature and mankind's survival instrument. And furthermore, it's not just the hero's values are not just globally or universally beneficial to human life, but also their personal values dear to, you know, egoistically, selfishly dear to the valuer. So, you know, a good example of that, you know, my all-time favorite hero out of American history, George Washington, you know, valued freedom for the American colonies against the British throne. I say he's my all-time favorite hero for his great things. Always recognize he was a slave owner, which is bad, very bad, but the principle of individual rights that the revolutionaries were fighting for was and remains the principle to end slavery, racism, and all these bad things. So George Washington's a good example of a real-life hero, that the value he stood for, freedom for the United States, is life-promoting and was something that was personally dear to him. So action in promotion of human life is one criterion of a great hero. A second one is prowess. I mean, a hero, to reach this exalted level, you have ability in some form that towers above the best of every man and every woman. Every man can't do what a hero does. So, you know, that prowess could be intellectual, it could be bodily, it could be some combination of those two. But the hero has an exalted capacity. You know, for example, let me take a fictitious example. Many good people, or in fact, all good people, would want to lock up criminals, protect the innocent from murderers, bring justice, and so forth. But the overwhelming majority of us don't have the genius of Sherlock Holmes, right? To solve the case, to bring justice, to protect the innocent. I mean, he's a towering hero in the field of crime detection. Now, a third criterion of a great hero is measured by the impediments and or the antagonisms faced. The achievement of noteworthy goals requires great effort to overcome recondite problems or difficulties. A good example here is Thomas Edison, who spent years of painstaking effort devoted to inventing the electric light. Now notice, heroes might face opposition from nature. Here, you know, here a great example, my favorite example, is Ernest Shackleton. Right? Everybody knows the Shackleton story, the great. If you don't know it, you know, in a way, I envy you. Get a copy of Alfred Lansing's book *Endurance*, you know, from Amazon, and read it. It is just extraordinary. Shackleton, the great Antarctic explorer, his ship, the *Endurance*, was crushed in ice. He had to cross 800 miles, you know, of the ocean in freezing weather, 50-foot waves. He's in an open boat, you know, lands on his island. They got to climb mountains that have never been climbed before. They're seamen. They're not mountaineers. They have no equipment. I mean, it's the most unbelievable survival story in human history. In fact, the British scientist explorer Raymond Priestley, talking about these great polar discoverers, said, you know, for scientific expertise, give me Robert Scott. For efficiency of travel, give me the great Norwegian explorer, Roald Amundsen. But if things seem hopeless and there's no way out and all is lost, get on your knees and pray for Ernest Shackleton. How's that? There's an epitaph for a hero. So you might face overwhelming forces of nature the way Shackleton did. You might face your tremendous hostility from society, say like Darwin, when he published his Origin of Species. The fundamentalists, of course, wanted to burn the book. Burn the book. Hell, they would have burned him if they had the political power to do so. But so heroes. Part of their heroism is the obstacles, the impediments, and or the antagonism that they face. And of course, quality number four is their dauntlessness, that they face such arduous struggle that they're undismayed by the problems or the opposition that they face. Now, the dauntlessness could take different forms. Perseverance, for example, and I think perseverance is an underrated virtue. The sheer stick-to-itiveness of a Thomas Edison and the years of struggle, you know, to invent the electric light system. It may take perseverance, it may take courage. Now, courage is a salient characteristic of a hero. So let's get a rough definition here. I see courage as integrity in a context. You remember Ayn Rand's definition of integrity? Loyalty in action to rational principles, not just to any old principles. I mean, Hitler had principles, right? The existence of a master race, the rightful place of the master race to conquer, enslave, and or annihilate the inferior races. He lived by these principles. He died for these principles. Does that make Hitler a man of integrity? No. No. And hell no. Moral virtues are character traits that promote human life, not traits that expunge or annihilate human life. So one of the most egregious mass murderers of human history holds no virtues, integrity or otherwise, which is why Ayn Rand's definition of integrity is commitment in action to rational principles, not just to any old principles. And I think courage is the same way. Courage is integrity in a context. You hold some rational value, some life-promoting value, and something threatens it. That value could be your life, people you love, your money, your home, the freedom of the nation that you love, or whatever. You hold some rational, healthy, life-promoting value, something threatens it, and you stand tall in support and or defense of that value. Courage is integrity in a context. Now, the key point here is this. I know I'm going fast. I got a lot of material. The key point is this. Whether a hero faces intractable impediments or life-threatening dangers or both, he is undaunted in their face. He's undismayed by problems, obstacles and or dangers that would daunt or dismay a lesser individual. And the fifth and final, well, I'll repeat them when I get through here, but the fifth and final most salient characteristic of a hero is that a hero achieves victory in some form. Now, the goal is to live well, so practical victory is preferred, but it's not required. Because if a hero faces hellish opposition and remains true to his principles and values, come hell or high water, then this represents a profound moral triumph and is enormously inspiring. For example, supposing that he had kept alive American military resistance to the British in support of freedom against overwhelming odds. The British troops were seasoned and experienced. His troops had no experience. He had to train them. They had no money. They couldn't be paid. They had no food to eat. They're starving. They're freezing to death at Valley Forge. Congress wants to relieve Washington himself of command. You know, in the face of all of these obstacles and opposition, Washington keeps alive military resistance in support of freedom for years. But let's say in the end, massive British reinforcements quash the rebellion. So does that mean Washington is defeated? Does that mean he's not a hero? Well, I don't think so. He's still and he gets hanged, let's say, you know, for his commitment to American freedom. That makes him they failed in his specific value quest, as did Shackleton, for that matter, who wanted to traverse the Antarctic continent. It means he failed in his specific value quest, but his undaunted commitment to a life-supporting value, living for and dying for a rational life-supporting value, makes him enormously heroic and inspiring. So, there are the five criteria of being a hero. Action in promotion of human life, prowess above and beyond that of every man, severe impediments and/or dangers faced, dauntlessness in the face of such dangers, and victory in some form. Now, who are the contenders? Who are the greatest heroes in world literature? Well, I have five candidates here, and they are, in historical order, Homer, the Odyssey, Odysseus, Edmond Rostand, Cyrano de Bergerac, Cyrano himself, of course, Henrik Ibsen, An Enemy of the People, Dr. Thomas Stockman, Jack Schaefer, Shane, the eponymous character named Shane, and of course, Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead and Howard Roark. So what makes these such great heroes? Who is the greatest of these heroes? Well, let's take a look. Let me get these papers out of the way, because we want to do some housework. Okay, here's what we want to know about the hero. What is his primary goal? Who or what antagonism does he confront? What is the ensuing conflict? And of course, since we're discussing literature here, can we identify what Ayn Rand called the plot theme in all of these great works, and the theme of these great works, and how does this contribute to our mastery our understanding of heroes, and who's the greatest of these heroes? So let's start with Odysseus, the Odyssey. How many people have read the Odyssey? Yeah, good. Objectivists generally know how to read. It's a good thing, given how the regressing U.S. educational system and fewer people graduate high schools, you'll be illiterate. It's heartbreaking. My college students could never understand the Odyssey. I don't even think they could read it. Well, you have a bizarre sense of humor. Well, I suppose there are some things in life about which you laugh or cry, and that's better to laugh at that than cry about it. Now, Odysseus. With Odysseus, of course, he's been away at the wars for 10 years, at the Trojan War. His goal is to win home to his wife, Penelope, and his son Telemachus, who was an infant when he left. The Odyssey is often referred to as the greatest adventure story in world literature, which I think is accurate, but that's only part of what the Odyssey is. The Odyssey is a homecoming story. Odysseus is coming home to his wife and his son, and there ain't nothing that's going to stop him. Antagonists? Have you read the antagonist? I mean, my answer to that is virtually everything imaginable. You want monsters? We got monsters. Polyphemus, the Cyclops. You want gods? We got gods. Poseidon, the god of the sea. You want storms? Oh, yeah, we got storms from Poseidon. You want witches and sorceresses? Yes, we got Circe, who turns Odysseus' men into swine. You want men? Actual human beings? Yeah, we have 100 of them at least. When Odysseus has to kill 108 suitors, Penelope's suitors, when he gets home. He hasn't gone through enough. Now he's got to kill 100 guys. You want goddesses? We got Calypso, who's in love with Odysseus and keeps him trapped on her island. You want temptations? Who was telling me last night Somebody was telling me, gave me that quote from Oscar Wilde, who said, "I can resist everything but temptation." That's Well, Calypso is beautiful. She's a goddess. She's in love with him. She offers him immortality. You talk about temptations. No, none of that could stop Odysseus. He's going home. And notice he's going home to certain death, because he'll get to spend however many years he and Penelope have left together. But he's going to die, like any of the rest of us. And he turns down Calypso's offer of immortality. I don't think I would. That's probably why I'm divorced. But anyway. anyhow, Odysseus triumphs over every foe and obstacle that's imaginable. I mean, it's a tour de force on Homer's part. Now, what's the plot theme in the Odyssey? Ayn Rand, I assume most people in this audience have read the Romantic Manifesto, and you know what Ayn Rand means by a plot theme. You know, you identify the essence of the story, the conflict, the action. Now, the plot theme of the Odyssey, like I said, I don't get these from Mount Olympus. It's not impossible. I made an error here. But the plot theme of the Odyssey is a brilliantly cunning warrior struggles against monsters, men, and gods to win home to his wife and son. I mean, that's the essence of hundreds of pages of conflict. A brilliantly cunning warrior struggles against monsters, men, and gods to win home to his wife and son. Now, the theme of the Odyssey, I got to admit, this stumped me. It was difficult to identify the theme, because there's different contenders here. First of all, there's the danger of incurring the gods' wrath. And Odysseus incurs Poseidon's wrath, and he pays a terrible price for it. But there's also the moral transgression of hubris, which would have resonated with the ancient Greeks. Because remember, after he blinds Polyphemus and escapes from the Cyclops, he makes the mistake of singing out, you know, "Nobody can defeat the mighty Odysseus." You know, and this is hubris, and of course this is how Polyphemus finds out who it was that blinded him, and goes complains to his father Poseidon, who keeps sending storms to wreck Odysseus' ships. So these are all possibilities. But I don't think that gets the essence of what the Odyssey shows us. Now, there's the danger of reading history backwards, you know, of reading objectivist principles into historical events. And there's a similar danger in literature. Of reading literature backwards, you know, of reading objectivist themes into an ancient text. So let's do this inductively and see if we can avoid that. Look at some of the specific events in the Odyssey. Notice that Odysseus outwits Polyphemus. He tells Polyphemus that the Cyclops originally, that his name is No Man. And so when he's roaring with pain, you know, and the other Cyclops said, "Well, who did this to you, Polyphemus?" He said, "No man did this to me." And the other Cyclops said, "Well, if no man did it, we'll just go home." You know, he outwits Polyphemus. He gets his men to cling to the bellies of the sheep or the cattle when they escape from the cave. Notice how he outsmarts the sirens. Nobody's ever heard the sirens call and survived. Odysseus wants to hear it, and so he has his men, first they plug their ears with wax, and then he has them lash him to the mast, you know, without any wax in his ears. "No matter what I say, don't let me loose." And, you know, he wants to jump overboard and swim to the beauty of the sirens' music, but he can't. He's been lashed to the mast at his own command, and he's the only person who's ever heard the siren song and lived. Notice how he outsmarts the suitors. He comes in disguise as a beggar, and without them knowing who he is, he lays his plans to kill all these guys. In the backstory, a major part of the backstory, at the how did the Greeks ultimately win at Troy? The stratagem of the Trojan horse was largely Odysseus's doing. Throughout both texts, the Iliad and the Odyssey, Homer is constantly referring to him as wily Odysseus, cunning Odysseus. He's beloved of Athena. Of all the Greeks, he's most beloved of Athena, the goddess of civilization and of intellect, because he's not just a great warrior, he is, but because of his brilliantly cunning mind. Odysseus's most salient heroic trait is his superbly cunning intelligence. I mean, Homer herein shows us that it is good to be the smartest kid on the block. And I think the theme of the Odyssey is the triumph of intelligence over every possible obstacle. And I don't think I'm reading objectivist themes into ancient texts. I think all these events dramatize that. The triumph of intelligence over every possible obstacle. Now, let's move on. This is great stuff. I mean, these are the greatest heroes in world literature. I mean, what could beat this, right? We ought to stay here all day and half the night and stay with this material. Cyrano. How many people have read Cyrano or seen the play? Yeah. Yeah, I once was at Leonard Peikoff's lecture in New York. I think it was the Objective Communication course in 1980, and Ayn Rand was there for the Q&A, and somebody asked her in the Q&A, could you please name the three greatest plays in the history of literature? And Ayn Rand responded, that's easy. Cyrano de Bergerac. Now, The goal of Cyrano is to win the love of the beautiful Roxanne via the stratagem of writing love letters for the handsome but dull Christian. Now the primary antagonist of this goal is his disfigurement. Right, he's got a nose, you know, that stretches from here to Canarsie, you know, and back. And so since he's physically ugly, you know, he's afraid that the beautiful Roxanne will never find him attractive. That's his original. There's an internal obstacle here to wooing Roxanne. That's his original obstacle. But later on, his loyalty to Christian and to Roxanne's memory of Christian also militates against him ever telling her the truth. Now the conflict here, you notice it's much broader than this, because Cyrano is this brilliant intellectual. He's a writer, he's a dramatist, he's a great swordsman, he's a great warrior, and he. You see his the reasons why he doesn't woo Roxanne, but at the same time, Cyrano has written these beautiful plays and poetry, but he can't get it published or the plays produced without the patronage of the cardinal, and he absolutely refuses to kiss up to the cardinal. And we would be remiss if we did not read this section. This is the Hooker translation of Cyrano, the most what I think of as the Ode to Independence. No need for me to assess it, just let me read it. His friend Lebret, Cyrano delights in telling the power brokers to like flip off, you know, I'm not gonna kiss up to you, you know, go to hell, I go my own way. So his friend Lebret says to him, you know, what madness, why do you go around making all these powerful enemies, like you deliberately make these powerful enemies? And Cyrano says, what would you have me do? Seek for the patronage of some great man, and like a creeping vine on a tall tree, crawl upward where I cannot stand alone? No, thank you. Dedicate, as others do, poems to pawnbrokers. Be a buffoon in the vile hope of teasing out a smile on some cold face? No, thank you. Eat a toad for breakfast every morning? Make my knees callous and cultivate a supple spine? Wear out my belly groveling in the dust? No, thank you. Scratch the back of any swine that roots up gold for me? Tickle the horns of mammon with my left hand while my right, too proud to know his part in his business, takes in the fee? No, thank you. Use the fire God gave me to burn incense all day long under the nose of wood and stone? No, thank you. Shall I go leaping into ladies' laps and licking fingers? Or, to change the form, navigating with madrigals for oars, my sails full of the size of dowagers? No, thank you. Publish verse at my own expense? No, thank you. Be the patron saint of a small group of literary souls who dine together every Tuesday? No, I thank you. Shall I labor night and day to build a reputation on one song and never write another? Shall I find true genius only among geniuses, palpitate over little paragraphs, and struggle to insinuate my name into the columns of the Mercury? No, thank you. Calculate, scheme, be afraid, love more to make a visit than a poem, seek introductions, favors, influences? No, thank you. No, I thank you. And again, I thank you. But to sing, to laugh, to dream, to walk in my own way and be alone, free, with an eye to see things as they are, a voice that means manhood, to cock my hat where I choose, at a word, a yes, a no, to fight or write, to travel any road under the sun, under the stars, nor doubt if fame and fortune lie beyond the bourne, never to make a line I have not heard in my own heart, yet, with all modesty to say, my soul, be satisfied with flowers, with fruit, with weeds even, but gather them in the one garden you may call your own. So, when I win some triumph by some chance, render no share to Caesar. In a word, I am too proud to be a parasite. And if my nature wants the germ that grows towering to heaven like the mountain pine, or like the oak sheltering multitudes, I stand, not high it may be, but alone. Librett. Alone, yes, but why stand against the world? What devil has possessed you now to go everywhere making yourself enemies? Cyrano, watching you other people making friends everywhere as a dog makes friends. I mark the manner of these canine courtesies and think, my friends are of a cleaner breed. Here comes, thank God, another enemy. I mean, this is just... I mean, this is just magnificent. This is literature at its best. So Cyrano refuses to kiss up to authority figures, and consequently, in the end, he achieves none of his goals. He refuses to reveal his secret love, his love to Roxanne. His brilliant plays are never produced. He's murdered by cowardly, perfidious foes. Above all, he's frustrated from reaching his prime goal by a misguided loyalty to Christian and to Roxanne's memory of Christian. Now, what's the plot theme of Cyrano? A disfigured man composes beautiful love letters for a friend to a woman they both love. A disfigured man composes beautiful love letters for a friend to the woman they both love. The theme? The supreme value of romantic love. This is the greatest ode to romantic love in world literature. The theme here is the supreme value of romantic love. And the essence of the essence of Odysseus's character is his brilliantly cunning intelligence. The essence of Cyrano's character, I think, even more than his exalted independence, is his impassioned capacity for romantic love. This is what really makes Cyrano stand out, his impassioned capacity for romantic love, and this play is the greatest ode to romantic love in world literature. Now, we don't have much time, so let's rock on. An enemy of the people. Now, Dr. Thomas Stockman, this is one of Ibsen's greatest plays. Dr. Stockman's goal is to stand up for the truth regarding the contaminated spa waters in his town and preserve the integrity of the spa and prevent sickness. The antagonist is every social foe imaginable. You look at the conflict in an enemy of the people. Everybody the town's economy depends upon the spa. The waters are tainted. He's the doctor. He discovered that they're tainted. He wants to close them down, you know, until they're purified. They've been closed down for a while in the attempt to purify them. The townspeople want to believe that they're purified. Dr. Stockman points out that they are not. Everybody stands against them, except his wife and children. Everybody else, his brother, the mayor, the business leaders, his friends in the press. He's condemned as an enemy of the people by the entire town. He stands on principle alone against the entire town. Now his wife, understandably horrified, you know, wails, you know, what are we going to do? They're going to hunt us down, and so forth. Listen to this. This is the very end of an enemy of the people. Dr. Stockman, are you utterly mad, Catherine? Hunt me down now when I'm the strongest man in town? Mrs. Stockman, the strongest now? Dr. Stockman, yes, I might go farther and say that now I'm the strongest man in the whole world. His son, Morton, you mean it? Dr. Stockman, lowering his voice, shh, don't talk about it yet, but I've made a great discovery. Mrs. Stockman, what, again? Dr. Stockman, yes, why not? Gathers them around him and speaks confidentially. And the essence of it, you see, is that the strongest man in the world is the one who stands most alone. Wow. What a noble insight on the part of Ibsen here. And so Ibsen hints at the victory of Dr. Stockman here. I mean, he's the strongest man in the world after all. But this is the last line of the play, so he doesn't show it. Now, what's the plot theme in An Enemy of the People? A small town doctor struggles against his entire community to preserve the integrity of the spa waters upon which the town's economy depends. A small town doctor struggles against his entire community to preserve the integrity of the spa waters upon which the town's economy depends. The theme here, the power of a lone thinking individual to identify and stand up for an unpopular truth. The power of a lone thinking individual to identify and stand up for an unpopular truth. Notice Dr. Stockman's most heroic trait is his fierce independence, his commitment to a life-saving truth, and his willingness to stand alone against an entire society. All right. I know they're going to kick us out soon, so let's rock on. Get to one of my all-time favorite novels, Shane. And if you guys haven't read Shane, read it yesterday. This is a beautiful book. I could never read it without crying. Now Shane's goal is conflicted. He's internally conflicted, which is part of what makes this such a great story. At first, the goal is to give up gunfighting and live a peaceful life. But that morphs into save the Starrett family. So the antagonist here, first of all, his initial goal of giving up gunfighting is confronted by the requirements of saving Joe Starrett and Starrett's the family he loves. And then the second goal, when his goal morphs into saving Starrett's family, the antagonist are the bad guys here, the cattle baron Fletcher and his hired gun Stark Wilson. Now, the ensuing conflict, Shane, the backstory, he's a gunfighter. We don't know anything about him. He's mysterious. He rides into this Wyoming valley. He takes a job working for Joe Starrett, who's an honest. Joe Starrett's like an objectivist hero. He's a productive man. He's an honest, hardworking, productive man. His son, Bobby, idolizes Shane. He's never seen Shane with a gun, but just Shane's his supple movement. I mean, he's more panther than he is human being. I mean, and Bobby idolizes the overwhelming physical prowess of the man. Fletcher, the cattle baron, wants the farm, Joe Starrett's a farm, he wants them off the land. They won't leave. He hires a killer, Stark Wilson, who kills one of Joe Starrett's allies, and he comes to the Starrett farm and he makes him an offer. He says, "You could stay, work for me. I'll hire your man, Shane, but the rest of the farmers have to go. I'll be in town. You have till tonight to let me know." Well, Joe Starrett's going to go into town and refuse. Shane knows Fletcher will have Stark Wilson kill him. Joe Starrett says, "Well, I got to go. It's my responsibility." Shane knocks him out. Rides into town alone, faces Fletcher and Wilson, kills them both, is wounded, and he leaves town because he does not want Bobby to grow up idolizing a gunfighter, no matter how noble. He wants him to grow up hero worshiping his father and be a peaceful, productive, honest man. And I got to say something here as an aside. Shane is the greatest work in world literature, fiction or nonfiction, on the virtue of hero worship. That's really at the deeper level, what this book is about the virtue of hero worship and who should a young kid grow up hero worshiping, the gunfighter, you know, or the productive objectivist kind of hero. Now, I could read this scene from Shane. I can't promise not to cry. The benevolence of this novel is just off the charts. This is after Shane has killed the bad guys, thereby saved Joe Starrett's life, thereby saved Joe's wife, Marion, from widowhood, and Bobby from orphanhood. And by the way, you should know Jack Schaefer hints at this attraction between Shane and Marion. There's a definite attraction there, and they both know Joe Starrett is the right man for Marion, not Shane. But Shane is a force of nature. He can't be resisted. And so when he leaves, he's not just saved Joe Starrett's life, he saved Marion's marriage. And he's also set up the situation so that Bobby grows up hero worshiping his father Joe, not the gunfighter. Marion later thanks him. He's not there. She's speaking to his image out the window in the wilderness. But when she thanks him, she says, "Thank you." She's thanking him for all of that. Now, Bobby's in hiding. He's witnessed the gunfight. He comes running out. And he, of course, wants his idol to stay. "Bob, yes, Shane. A man is what he is, Bob. And there's no breaking the mold. I tried that and I've lost. But I reckon it was in the cards from the moment I saw a freckled kid on a rail up the road there and a real man behind him, the kind that could back him for the chance another kid never had. But Shane, you, there's no going back from a killing, Bob. Right or wrong, the brand sticks and there's no going back. It's up to you now. Go home to your mother and father. Grow strong and straight and take care of them, both of them. Yes, Shane. There's only one thing more I can do for them now. I felt the horse move away from me. Shane was looking down the road and onto the open plain, and the horse was obeying the silent command of the reins. He was riding away, and I knew that no word or thought could hold him. The big horse, patient and powerful, was already settling into the steady pace that had brought him into our valley, and the two, the man and the horse, were a single dark shape in the road as they passed beyond the reach of the light from the windows." I mean, you just see the nobility of this. Now, okay, so what's the plot theme here in Shane? A gunfighter must choose between giving up a life of violence and saving the family he loves. That's the plot theme of Shane. A gunfighter must choose between giving up a life of violence and saving the family he loves. The theme, you see Jack Schaefer's determinist philosophy here. The theme is the inescapability of one's nature. Shane tried to give up gunfighters, but it's who he is. It's in his DNA. He can't. And Shane's most heroic trait is his unparalleled physical prowess. Now, should we get to the fountainhead? Yeah. Well, actually, you know what? Let me make a couple last points about Shane. Notice that in saving the Starrett family, he ipso facto, you know, by the very nature of that in itself, returns to gunfighting, abandoning his original goal of leading a peaceful life. Further, he saves the Starrett family only to lose them in another form. And the bitter irony here of the very act of protective violence that saves them physically alienates him from them forever. The very act of saving them alienates him from the people he loves forever. This is the sad quality in Shane. All right. Now, let's get to Howard Rourke. How are we doing on time? We don't have a lot of time. Now, Rourke's goal, of course, is to gain commercial success as an architect on his own terms. The antagonist, every type of intellectual, psychological, moral type of dependency imaginable. I don't have to tell the story in the fountainhead to this audience, right? Could save a minute? Thank you. He's opposed by traditionalists like Guy Franken and Ralston Holcomb, who copied the designs of the past. He's opposed by the conformists like Peter Keating, who just give to the clients whatever they want. He's opposed by the collectivists, Ellsworth Toohey, who want to impose a socialist dictatorship in America. Even his own lover, Dominique Franken, joins forces with Toohey in an anti-Rourke alliance. Now, notice that Rourke wins this conflict definitively. By the end of the story, he builds the Winan building. He rebuilds Cortland Holmes exactly as he designed it. He's acquitted at his trial. He gains commercial success and a just recognition on his own terms. You could listen to Sinatra sing My Way. You know, it reminds me of the life and career of Howard Rourke. He wins the battle and gets the girl. He saves Dominique Franken's soul, and a lot I could say on that, but we don't have time. And he wins her love forever. Of course, he won her love the first time she ever saw him in the Grand Accord. Now, the plot theme in The Fountainhead is a brilliant young architect struggles against the entrenched beliefs of a conservative society to win acceptance for his revolutionary ideas. That's the plot theme of The Fountainhead. A brilliant young architect struggles against the entrenched beliefs of a conservative society to win acceptance for his revolutionary ideas. The theme, nobody could state it as well as Ayn Rand did. Individualism versus collectivism, not in politics, but in men's souls. Now, I don't know what that means, but it sounds deep. No, actually... Actually, I know exactly what it means, and it's a brilliant expression of the theme here. Expressed in other terms, what that means is cognitive moral independence versus cognitive moral dependency of every type. Now, Rourke's most heroic trait is his unwavering commitment to his own judgment in every arena of life. Now, independent judgment is implicit in being a revolutionary thinker. So we see this in Rourke's career. But also, Rourke also manifests this in his personal life as well, in all aspects of his life. Notice Austin Heller, his close friend, one of his oldest friends. Heller warns him against his relationship with Gail Winan. You know, understandably so from Heller's standpoint. And Rourke says, I'll listen to you, Austin, but, you know, I recognize in Winan something much deeper than the corruption of the Winan papers. And he has a soulmate relationship with the great tragic hero. And Winan has done some really bad things. Let's not sugar candy coat this. Winan is not always such a good guy. But Rourke recognizes the deeper, the goodness in wine, and that's what he responds to. You see him going by his own judgment, even, you know, when his trusted friend is warning him, and with good reason to warn him. And I think also the contrast with Henry Cameron really highlights Rourke's independence, because Cameron, too, is independent. He's committed to his revolutionary designs. He won't budge on this. He throws an inkstand at some client who wants him to add, you know, Greek ornamentation. He throws guys out of his office for, you know, and screams at them. Maybe he's tempted to beat these guys up because they disagree with his designs. You know, Cameron is fiercely independent in his professional life. But notice up to here, the rejection on the part of society, it rankles Cameron. It festers in his soul. It bothers him. It hurts him. At an emotional level, social assessment matters to him. And this is what makes him bitter and an alcoholic in the end. That negative social assessment doesn't do that to Roy. Like he tells Dominique, it's a pain that goes down to a certain point, and then it stops. Well, where does it stop, she wants to know? Well, we'll talk about the Stoddard temple. It stops at the point where I know I designed that temple, and it is a masterpiece, whatever society says. It's like the analogy, I think, is if we're in California and an earthquake destroys the, you know, the temple, I've lost my baby. It's painful. But the social rejection means little or nothing. I've lost my baby, but that I was rejected by society doesn't matter. I know what a masterpiece this is. Now, we only have a few minutes. Let's make sure we can wrap this up. All right. Now, let's assess these. Look, we're in the Hero Hall of Fame. We're looking for Babe Ruth, you know, or Willie Mays, or Hank Aaron. Who's the greatest baseball player? That's a discussion also. Well, we're in the Hero Hall of Fame. We have some of the greatest heroes. Nobody's getting kicked out of the Hall of Fame here. These guys all, they're at the upper echelons. But who's the greatest? Can we identify them? Now, let's go to our checklist. Odysseus, life-affirming values, romantic love and family, the value of romantic love and family. Check it off. Opposition faced? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Everything imaginable. Yeah, check it off. Ability, capacity, prowess, a superlative combination of intellectual with martial prowess. Check that box. Virtue, his formidable intelligence placed in service of life-affirming values. He's going home to his wife and son, and nothing's going to stop him. Victory, definitive, crushing in every possible way. Odysseus is a mighty hero. He may be the greatest hero in ancient literature. But notice there's a problem here. Looking at it from an objectivist standpoint, much of the antagonism here is mythical. In reality, there are no gods, there are no sorcerers or sorceresses, there are no monsters, not like the Cyclops anyway. We need to grant an author his culture. And this is magnificent literary art, and Odysseus is a mighty hero. But in reality, there are no, you know, monsters or gods. And similarly, in romantic fiction, in realistic fiction, there will not be any. And so I think we need to say the generous dosage of mythic elements in the story, including and especially amongst the antagonists, diminishes Odysseus' stature as a realistic hero. Let me repeat that. The generous dosage of mythic elements in the story, including and especially among the antagonists, diminishes Odysseus' stature as a realistic hero. Overcoming a monster like Polyphemus is not as daunting and is not as impressive as overcoming a monster like Ellsworth Tui. So Odysseus undoubtedly is a great hero, but he's not the greatest realistic hero. Now Cyrano, life-affirming values, impassioned romantic love. Check the box. Opposition faced, enemies of every kind. Prowess, Like Odysseus, he combines brilliant intellect with being a mighty warrior. There's that great opening scene where he's composing a poem while he's dueling this guy. And like Muhammad Ali, he predicts the moment at which he's gonna stab and possibly, on the refrain, thrust home. His prowess, combined intellect and warrior status is virtually unparalleled. Virtues, his magnificent independence, integrity that we just, even as he's dying, his enemies drop a gigantic log on his head. They've crushed his skull. He knows he's dying. He keeps his date with Roxanne. He comes to visit her in the convent to tell her the news. Even at dying, he's remained true to his misguided devotion to Christian and Roxanne's memory of Christian. He won't tell the truth. Even when Roxanne guesses it, "You love me," she says. And he's, "No, my dearest love, I love you not." You know, and even at the end, as he's dying, he draws his sword. You know, corruption, yeah. You know, hypocrisy, yeah. Dishonesty. Even to his death, he's fighting these immoralities. You see his great character, but notice the heartbreaking irony in this play. This is the greatest ode to romantic love in world literature, but no love ever gets made. All the main characters live and die as virgins. Remember the scene, De Guiche, who wanted Roxanne, when he finds out she married Christian, he drags Christian off to the wars. He said, he tells Cyrano, the wedding night must be postponed. And Cyrano says under his breath, "That causes me no great pain." You know, the greatest ode to romantic love ever written, and no love ever gets made. The three main characters live and die as virgins. What's the fundamental reason for that? Because Cyrano never tells Roxanne the full truth. And a major sub-theme in this play is the dangers of duplicity, no matter how benign. The dangers of duplicity, no matter how benign. What Cyrano should do is he should have manned up at the outset. He should have told Roxanne, "I love you," with all of his beautiful eloquence, he should have told her. He should have told her the truth and let her make her choice. Now that's easy for me to say, good-looking guy, heartthrob amongst the ladies. Nevertheless, look, everybody. I assume many people in this audience have been heartbroken in romantic love at some point, right? Yeah, we know what that feels like, the knife wound to the heart, the agony. I don't wish that on anybody, but, you know, maybe guys in ISIS. But so Cyrano's got this disfigurement. Cyrano's got this major disfigurement. We empathize why he's afraid to tell Roxanne the truth. We empathize sincerely with that. But, you know, my response to that is, you're Cyrano, for God's sake. You face every enemy imaginable. You're a towering hero. You're a gigantic hero. This is cowardly. This is not worthy of your status as a hero. This is cowardly. Man up and tell her. He needs to man up and tell her. He never does. And this is not only the reason why no love ever gets made in this play. This is a flaw in Cyrano that diminishes his otherwise towering heroic stature. Now, Dr. Stockman, of course, your life-affirming values, yes. The beneficial purity of the spa waters and full disclosure. Opposition faced every social foe possible. Businessmen, politicians, family, the press. Prowess, he's the most powerful man in the world. You see his virtues, well, you see his fierce commitment to the truth. Victory, well, certainly at least in a moral sense. You could tell from this character, he's never going to back down. He's never going to give in. He's going to stand up until the very end. But herein lies the problem. Ibsen does not show Armageddon. He does not show, Ibsen does not show the final battle between good and evil. Now, this does not affect the status of the play. It's a self-contained, brilliant unit. It doesn't affect the heroism of the character. We know he'll never surrender. But for a definitive assessment of a hero, we need to see him in the final climactic confrontation with the antagonists. Let me repeat that. For a definitive assessment of a hero, we need to see him in a final climactic confrontation with the antagonists. And we never do. And this undermines Stockman's stature relative to some of these other heroes. Now, with Shane, we have life-affirming values. Yes, protect the best members of society. Opposition faced, toughest in the valley. Prowess, off the charts. Virtues, he's got the courage to risk his life for the best members of this society. Victory, definitive. But there's a few minor problems. First of all, Shane's prowess is almost entirely physicalistic. And it's great, it's necessary, at times that's necessary to save human life, but it is not, your gunfighting is not the most powerful weapon that a hero might possess or deploy. Furthermore, Jack Schaefer's determinism undermines Shane's heroism because from Jack Schaefer's standpoint, Shane could do no different. He could not do otherwise. He's like a force of nature. He is. In reality, Shane made this choice to risk his life to save the best members of. If we accept Jack Schaefer's philosophy, and it's his book, his universe, if we accept Jack Schaefer's philosophy, it diminishes Shane's stature as a hero. So he's got two problems. Now, Rourke, let me wrap this up. Life-affirming values, revolutionary designs and building, yes. Opposition faced, every type of social foe. Ellsworth Toohey does not get the love from objectivist audiences that he deserves. Now, let's give Ellsworth Toohey some love because he is, in my judgment, the greatest villain in world literature. He is the most brilliant villain in world literature. His Stoddard Temple scam is brilliant. He makes Iago look like an American college kid by comparison. Now, there's a lot I wanted to say in Ellsworth Toohey, but I don't have the time. But I'll say this. Ellsworth Toohey is the most brilliant literary representative of history's most heinous evil, collectivism. Ellsworth Toohey is the most brilliant literary representative of history's most heinous evil, collectivism. And it's the collectivism and the social push towards collectivism from the left that gives Ellsworth Toohey tremendous social power. If you want to have the greatest hero in literature, he's got to be confronted by the greatest villain. He's got to be confronted by a powerful villain. Prowess, Howard Rourke, prior to Atlas Shrugged, and leaving Atlas Shrugged aside, Howard Rourke is not only the most brilliant creative mind in the universe of the story, Howard Rourke is the most brilliant creative mind in the history of world literature, prior to Atlas Shrugged. His victory is his virtues, of course, his independence and integrity. His victory is definitive. He routs Toohey at the trial. He gains commercial success on his own terms. He wins the battle and gets the girl. So let me wrap this up. Howard Rourke confronts, as a primary antagonist, the most heinous evil in human history, collectivism. Toohey's a Marxist intellectual. But as his primary strength, Rourke possesses and deploys the most powerful instrument on earth, human genius, the independent, individual, reasoning mind. Howard Rourke's victory over Ellsworth Toohey presages, in fiction and in microcosm, individualism's victory in reality over collectivism, first in the form of National Socialism in World War II, and second over Soviet Communism in the Cold War. Let me repeat that. Rourke's victory over Toohey presages in fiction and in microcosm individualism's victory in reality over both National Socialism in World War II and Communism in the Cold War. Of all these heroes, Rourke is by far the most formidable because he harnesses the most awesome of nature's creations, human genius. This is what enables him to decisively defeat the most powerfully evil villain in realistic literature. Ayn Rand creates the most powerful hero in realistic literature because she recognizes the power of man's mind in real life. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.